From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen about their terrific new thriller, Eastern Promises. Mortensen plays the menacing driver for a Russian crime family in London, a family involved in drugs, sex trafficking, and murder. Cronenberg and Mortensen also worked together on the film A History of Violence. Also, music critic Milo Miles considers the longevity of the music of Sonic Youth. Their 1988 album Daydream Nation has been reissued. And our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers all the talk about civility and incivility. Why are we using those words? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After teaming up on the film A History of Violence, director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen have made a new film called Eastern Promises. Cronenberg also made Scanners, The Fly, Videodrome, and Dead Ringers. Mortensen co-starred in the Lord of the Rings films, A Walk on the Moon, and A Perfect Murder. Eastern Promises is a thriller set in London. A pregnant teenage girl collapses in a pharmacy and is rushed to the hospital where she dies in childbirth. The nurse midwife takes a special interest in the orphaned infant. She takes the mother's diary, which is written in Russian, and tries to get it translated so she can track down the baby's extended family. The diary leads her to a Russian restaurant she doesn't realize is owned by the head of a Russian crime family. She also doesn't know that the boss is interested in the diary because he's worried it may implicate him in a series of crimes. In this scene, after the midwife's first visit to the restaurant, she's driven home by the family's driver, a menacing-looking character who also does a lot of the family dirty work. The midwife is played by Naomi Watts, the driver by Viggo Mortensen.
Have you ever met a girl called Tatiana?
I meet a lot of girls called Tatiana.
She was pregnant.
Ah, in that case, no, I never heard of her.
She died on my shift.
I thought you did birth.
Sometimes birth and death go together. She came in with needle punches all over both arms. Probably a prostitute, the age of 14. Do you think Semyon's son knew her?
I'm a driver. I go left, I go right, I go straight ahead, that's it.
I'll take the next right.
David Cronenberg, Viggo Mortensen, welcome to Fresh Air. This is really an incredible film, and I want the audience to enjoy it as much as I did, so I don't want to give too much away, but at the same time, I want to be able to talk with you in some depth about the film, so I'll try to strike a balance. David Cronenberg, what was in the screenplay that made you think this is a David Cronenberg film?
Oh, I'd never look for that. I first of all, I don't know what a David Cronenberg film is. A lot of people have tried to tell me. I have no idea. I know people sometimes think I have a little checklist of things. You know, there has to be body consciousness, there has to be transformation, there has to be this and that. But I absolutely, in fact, try very hard to eradicate my entire body of work from my mind and really think only about the project as it floats uniquely, its own little world with its own little ecosystem, because I know that when I'm making the film, that's what I have to do. I have to forget everything else. You know, I have to really only allow that movie to tell me what it wants, and I listen to that, and I don't think about anything else.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that has that little checklist for what makes a David Cronenberg film, and this kind of
that's a critical thing. You know, that's a critical thing, and it's an analytical thing.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, when I'm doing interviews, I find it quite a fascinating process because it means I have to be articulate about things that I was actually inarticulate about before and only intuitive about before. So it's only now, you know, after the movie's made, that I start to have to actually be able to speak about it.
David, would you describe the Russian criminal organization that you portray in the movie?
Well, they're Russian. I can't really describe. I mean, it's a many-headed hydra, you know. It's very interesting. I mean, one of the books that I read when I was doing research for this movie was called Violent Entrepreneurs, and it was about the role of criminality in the rise of current Russian capitalism. And in a way, since the fall of the Soviet Union, what we have seen is, if you're looking at it just as a social scientist, it's very interesting because you're seeing the rawest, most virulent form of capitalism possible as it arises out of Russia. And most of the oligarchs and that we have heard about have definitely had criminal past. I mean, there's almost no other way to start your life as a Russian capitalist without dealing with criminals if in fact you aren't one yourself. So that, to me, that was the underpinning for me. That is kind of, they're kind of ardent capitalists really first, and then they also have this whole past that goes beyond communism back to the Tsarist days and the days of Russian prisons, where in which there was a bond formed that sort of floated outside of society. It was a brotherhood of thieves, the Vori Vezakoni, which means thieves in law, literally. It's not really like the mafia, because at that time it had nothing to do with businesses and having a facade of respectability. You were a thief, and your thievery was written on your body in tattoos. I mean, it was obvious to anybody who knew how to read your body like a book, who you were, where you were, what your sexual orientation was, how many crimes you committed, what prisons you had been in, how much time you did there. So that's the sort of underpinning of this group, which we have to understand is a displaced group. This is the Russian mob in London. So it's not only is it a strange form of Russian criminality, but it's a kind of an exported kind that's growing in a very specific way in a different soil. It's not in the black earth of Russia. It's now in the green earth of England.
Viggo Mortensen, you play a member of this Russian crime organization, a branch that is in London, a branch of emigres there, and you are covered in tattoos. And as mm-hmm. David Cronenberg explained, each of those tattoos is supposed to say something about your past, about who you are. Actors always talk about how the clothing they wear helps them get into character. What did having all those tattoos on your body do for you?
Well, it was helpful, and it does say a lot. And even if you don't know what David was talking about, even if you're not a Russian criminal or an expert in Russian criminal tattoos, old school tattoos, you do feel that there's something, and there is symbolically something about, apart from it being either off-putting or, well, certainly remarkable that you see this person covered and that their fingers have tattoos and everything else. That was mentioned sort of in passing in the original script, that there were some tattoos, but it didn't really go into specifics. And a friend of mine named Alex Lambert directed a very good documentary about 7 years ago, I guess now, or 8 years ago, called The Mark of Cain. And it's an amazing documentary. I recommend it if you can find it. And she did something, you know, remarkable and brave, actually. She went into maximum security prisons in Russia not long after, you know, the change from the Soviet Union to what is now Russia. And she talked to these people, and, you know, they became comfortable enough to reveal all kinds of things, not just about the tattoos in great detail, what they mean, you know, that the religious sort of tattoos that you see on my body in this movie, they don't necessarily have anything whatsoever to do with religion. They're part of the thieves' code, and my body is, you know, sort of my calling card,
my passport.
Yeah.
This documentary plus another book that he discovered called Russian Criminal Tattoo, which is a fantastic book. These were sent to me by Viggo, and were completely mind-blowing. And I sent them to Steve Knight, the writer of the script, and I said, Steve, when you see these, you're going to want to do a rewrite, a major rewrite with me that will incorporate the tattooing subculture as a major part of the movie, as a central metaphor of the movie. It was as though the script was kind of waiting for this, but it was Viggo who gave it to us. So that's, you know, we as I say, I mean, it is a collaboration on every level, and it's great when it works.
I don't want to give away too much of the film, but there's one scene I just absolutely have to talk with you about, and anyone who sees this movie will want to hear what you have to say about this scene. There's an incredible scene in a steam bath where Viggo Mortensen, your character, is asked there for a meeting, and when the meeting is over, you're sitting there alone, naked, except you're completely covered in these tattoos that we've been talking about, these tattoos that have imprinted your life story on your body. Then, for reasons I won't explain, two fully clothed thugs come into the steam bath and begin to try to kill you with their fists and with knives. And you're there completely naked in this fight scene, covered with the tattoos. Your blood mixes with the ink of the tattoos. It's an incredible scene in so many ways. And I guess, David Cronenberg, let me start with you here. What are some of the things that you wanted from this scene? I mean, I've never seen anything like it before.
Mm. Well, first of all, I wanted to humiliate Vigo because it's part of our relationship. So anything that I can do that, I take advantage of immediately. Yeah. But, well, I guess it ends up being our shower scene from Psycho, you know. I mean, there, weirdly enough, I think some of the dynamics are the same. That is to say, how vulnerable can you ever be? And when you're wet and naked, that seems to, and people are coming at you with knives, that seems to be kind of the bottom line for vulnerability. Of course, it's all set up on many levels in the movie. It's not just dropped in sort of gratuitously. But the other thing, too, is that my approach to movies, and in particularly this movie, is that it's that people come to a movie to live another life. You know, they come there to be someone else, to inhabit someone else, and I take that to be physically as well. So I want the audience to be Vigo in this scene, to be Nikolai. And then that means that the way I shoot it, I want it to be experienced fully and physically. And therefore, I don't use sort of the Bourne movie type impressionistic quick cutting, which is certainly a valid approach to action and has its own effect. But I want the audience to see everything and feel everything as it really happens, or as close as you can get making a movie. So when the stunt coordinator, who was helping the actors work out the action, talks to me, I want to see everything. I want it all to make physiological sense. I want it to be logical. I want it to be hard work. I don't want to skip over anything. No jump cutting, no slow motion. I want it to feel real, absolutely real. Of course, everybody says, well, you know, you've got a star who's doing a scene naked and it's not a sex scene. I mean, this is unusual. But I say, well, you know, it was a very quick discussion. We were working out the choreography and Vigo said, well, you know, it's obvious I have to do this naked. And I said, yeah, okay. And that was pretty much it, you know, for that discussion.
Mm-hmm. It's not just, it's not a scene where it's like, ooh, it's Viggo Mortensen nude. It's a scene where it's like, here is this man facing his mortality naked in the world. And this scene just gives such a powerful sense of the human body's resilience and vulnerability, and of this one man's resilience and vulnerability. And it's just, I don't know, it also just seems to me as how, like, you enter the world and you come out of the world, you know, naked. That's, no matter what kind of stuff you put on, you are finally naked. And I just think it's a wonderful scene. At the same time, you had to deal with all the practicalities of shooting an actor naked and making sure that everything was exposed in the way you wanted it to be exposed, and not to call.
You're not talking about film exposure, are you?
No, no. But I mean, right?
I didn't
overemphasize like the genital part of the. You wanted to be there, but not overemphasize.
The truth is that I didn't think about those things when I was shooting it. I mean, that was the freedom that I had with Vigo. You know, I mean, it would have been silly for him to have a towel wrapped around him that never moved in a scene like that.
Right.
And it would have been very restrictive for me if I had to not show anything from sort of belly button to knees or something like that. So I actually didn't worry about how we were shooting it. That was the freedom that I had, whether things were flattering, not flattering, attractive, not attractive. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the difference between shooting with an actor who is constantly worried about how he looks, does he look good, does his skin look good, and so on, you know, and you have to light him that way, and that takes a terrible toll on the mood of a movie, for example, if you can't light it dramatically because the actor's wrinkles show, for example. And this was a sort of an equivalent of that. It could have been, but I actually totally didn't worry about it. I shot it the way I would have shot it if he had been wearing clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Viggo Mortensen, did you think about that at all?
No, I mean, I was aware of the fact, and we discussed that in passing when we were working out the fact, you know, we're also friends, and he's courteous, and he's just being practical. So what I'm thinking, how long it's going to take to shoot, and he shot it in about half the time anybody would. I don't think if you had twice the budget, you would have shot it any
differently. No, that's right. We had lots of time.
And most directors, even not using slow motion and everything else, with the angles and having to use three rooms and flying around all over the place, they would have probably taken a good week to do it. He did it in 2 days, which I was glad of that because, you know, I did get a little banged up for obvious reasons. I couldn't have pads and things on my knees and elbows and back and whatnot. And the quicker it was over in a way, the better. And the quicker they moved along in the day, the better. Because after they'd say cut, you know, I would become a little self-conscious at times, but not so much. I mean, I played it the same way he shot it, as if I had clothes. It was just a scene about a particular thing. And I did think towards the end, when I started to accumulate a certain amount of bruises, that they did have to airbrush to cover.
Well, they did, actually.
I thought it was karmic retribution for what happened to Maria Bello on the wooden stairs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. She was the one who got bruised there, and he got bruised here.
Yeah, they're referring, by the way, for our listeners who don't know, to a very kind of rough sex scene in History of Violence, which is the previous film that David Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen collaborated on.
Maria phoned me and wanted to be one of the killers in that scene of Viggo,
really,
but I couldn't make it work.
The one who kicks me.
My guests are director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen. Their new film is called Eastern Promises. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the new thriller Eastern Promises with the film's director David Cronenberg and its star Viggo Mortensen. Early in the movie, the mysterious woman whose past we don't know, but she's probably been a sex slave, walks into a pharmacy and she's hemorrhaging. She's pregnant and she's hemorrhaging. And she passes out, and as she passes out, slips on her own blood.
Yeah.
David Cronenberg, can you talk about shooting blood? You had to shoot a lot of it in this movie. And how you wanted the blood to look, and even the idea of, yeah, blood would be slippery if there was that much of it.
Oh, yeah. Blood, I mean, the human body contains quite a lot of blood, and there are different colors of it because there's oxygenated blood that goes through your arteries, and it's actually shockingly bright red. In fact, if you really shot it the way it looked, people would think it was fake. And then there's venous blood that goes through your veins, which has not been oxygenated, and that's much darker and almost brown. And so you're playing with people's understanding of blood and their expectations and what they've seen in other movies. And that's actually an interesting question, because long discussions with Stéphane Dupuis, who's a special effects man and makeup man who I've worked with since he won an Oscar with me for The Fly, and we go back even further than that, so probably 30 years of working with this man, and we always end up with a discussion of, okay, do you think this is the right, do you like the color, do you like this color? And it also has to do with the way it's lit. You see, it has to, your director of photography is involved as well, because it will take different colors depending on the film stock and how he's lit it and so on.
And what surface it's on. If it's on your body or for in the bathhouse, for example, when it's on, comes
on
off
tiles.
My back on the tiles,
yeah.
It looks different when it's on a lighter surface.
That's right. So it is a discussion, because it's a movie reality rather than a real reality. I like it to be fairly red and dark and not too bright.
I want to make it really clear that when I talk about how much blood there is in your film, it's not like, ooh, it's gory. I mean, the film is so much about, like, when you shoot blood, that blood is the essence of life, and the letting of blood, like, is the absence of life. Like, without it,
well,
it's,
if
like,
you want to get
it's
into
like the difference between life and death, this one liquid.
If you can talk about Isaac and sacrifices as well, because there's some of that in this movie. If you want to get biblical about this movie, there's plenty there. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
One more thing about the violence thing.
Yeah.
To me, you know, and obviously History of Violence, because things seem shockingly real when there was violence, people commented on it a lot and, you know, thought it was well done or were appalled or whatever mixture of feelings they had about it. And it's the same in this movie, and we're talking about it a great deal, obviously. But in screen time, it's very, very small percentage of the story. The story, and, you know, people are maybe better able to see all the layers on second viewing or on second thought as they go out and think about this movie after seeing it. But it's mostly not about violence at all, and it's mostly not about blood either.
No, I mean, there are literally three scenes of violence in this movie. That's it, three, and two of them are very short. They do have an impact, but when you think of a movie like, I don't know, you know, The Departed or something like that, the body count in this movie is very low by comparison.
Mm-hmm. And that's in part why it registers so much, because life isn't cheap in this movie.
Like it's not.
And every ounce of blood really matters.
That's a good point, because I philosophically, you know, it's easy reading statistics every day in the paper about how many people are killed in various hideous things around the world.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about violence, you're really talking about bodies, the destruction of a body that's an incredibly complex, precious, unique thing. The death of any person is definitely a tragedy, because whoever it is, however old that person is, he or she embodies experiences that are absolutely unique. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it's a hideous thing, and not to be taken lightly, not to be thrown away. And if you're going to show it, it sounds like I'm being hypocritical, but I totally am not. I mean, I think that to be casual about it in a movie is really a heinous, you know, offense against the preciousness of a human life. And so if you're going to kill somebody in your movie, it should mean something. The person should mean something. And it should mean something to the audience. I shouldn't let them off the hook easily.
David Cronenberg directed and Viggo Mortensen stars in the new thriller Eastern Promises. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen. Milo Miles considers how well the music of Sonic Youth has held up. Their 1988 album, Daydream Nation, has been reissued. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how we use the terms civility and incivility and what that says about us. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Cronenberg, director of the new film Eastern Promises, and the film's star, Viggo Mortensen. They previously worked together on the film A History of Violence. In Eastern Promises, Mortensen plays a Russian emigre in London who did time in Russian prisons. He's now a driver for a Russian crime family and does a lot of their dirty work. Viggo Mortensen, you not only had to learn a Russian accent for the movie, you have to speak with a really commanding presence and sometimes a very menacing voice, which is totally unlike how you're speaking now. You sound very soft-spoken. completely non-threatening, the way you're speaking now.
You should see him, though. Yeah, he's scary. Yeah. if you're in a booth with him, he's really scary.
Would you talk a little bit about what you did vocally, both in terms of the accent, but also in terms of the menace that your voice sometimes assumes?
Well, there's one thing that I've noticed or that has been brought to my attention, and it makes sense to me. You know, people have said, I speak Spanish because I was raised in until I was 11, mostly in a Spanish-speaking country in Argentina. So I speak Spanish like I do English. And also because of my family living there, I speak Danish. But when I speak Spanish, for example, people have said to me, you sound different, you seem, not just the words, but the tone and your body language is different. And it's something that the language informs you, the sounds you make, and the ideas behind them, the sort of concepts that are particular to a culture and a language, change the way you present yourself, even without you realizing it. And with Russian, there are sounds in that language that helped me and that did a lot of the work for me.
What were some of the sounds within the Russian-accented English you had to speak that helped you get the power that you needed for the role?
Well, I wasn't conscious of them, and they come under that thing of, well, I don't want to analyze, I don't want
sure,
to kill
yeah,
something.
Okay,
I just felt different. It was like you talked about earlier, you know, when the actor first tries on his wardrobe or his costume and starts to get used to it and, you know, like I like to, you know, can I borrow the watch and can I borrow the shoes and break them in and make them my own so I feel comfortable? It helps you. It does a lot of the work for you. And the language in this case really helped. There are, you know, I had the advantage from speaking some Latin language that certain R sounds or J, hard J sounds, I could get to them easier. But there are some vowel sounds or combinations of sounds that are particular to Russian. And also Ukrainian, which I speak a little bit of in the movie, but although you wouldn't know it, there's a transition into Ukrainian briefly that a Russian would know or a Ukrainian. But those sounds were a little harder to get, you know, the ones that are very specific. But we eventually got there. It was the effort of getting there that also, I just found myself moving differently and seeming different when I was concentrating on getting those sounds right. I can't explain it exactly, and I don't know that I'd want to know, break it down completely. I mean, I just know that it made things different, and it was as important to me as the clothing, as the car that I had to drive in my occupation as chauffeur for these underworld types.
David Cronenberg, Viggo Mortensen was best known for his roles in The Lord of the Rings, and is still probably best known for that. But you saw, I think, a different quality in him. And I'm wondering, why did you want to start working with him? I think what we see of him in A History of Violence and in your new film, Eastern Promises, is just kind of different than what we're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And what did you see in him, and how did you notice it? How did you know you wanted to work with him?
Two things. He was cheap. And he was available. That's pretty much it. I mean, that's what I look for from any actor.
And obedient.
Cheap, available, and obedient. Three things. Well, I think my interest in Viggo didn't have anything to do with Lord of the Rings because, frankly, I didn't think that was his most interesting performance just because of the nature of those movies. Talk about mythic, you know, and feeling that you had to be mythic. I think that was all there in that movie. Not what I would look for in an actor, really. That's, to me, that movie is not a movie that you would go to, or those series of movies, to check out an actor's performance. But I've seen him in a lot of things, everything from G.I. Jane to Carlito's Way to, you know, a lot of stuff. And I just thought he was really quite interesting visually and in presence, and obviously had a good ear for languages, a musical ear. It didn't surprise me to finally realize that he spoke fluent Spanish and Danish and pretty good French and some Italian, some German maybe. And also, for both movies, more for this one, but even for History of Violence, accent, language was a key thing. in a weird way, Eastern Promises is about language, and to a lesser extent, but still important, History of Violence was too. Now Vigo's really doing two accents in History of Violence, because the sort of Indiana accent is not his natural accent, and it's very subtle. And then there's the Philly accent that comes later, that is, you know, also extremely subtle but really important. So there, and then once we had worked together, I realized that he wasn't just good; he was great, I have to say. And so then, of course, he was a marked man for me, because now I want him to be in every movie that I do. When I was reading Eastern Promises and reading the role of Nikolai, it reminded me that Vigo had always seemed to me to have a Slavic element to his looks, to his face, to his cheekbones. And I don't know whether that's Danish and some great-grandmother was messing around with Russians, or I don't know. You never know. But and I had thought that when we were shooting History, because a director has a relationship with an actor that's really quite bizarre and not much known, which continues beyond the actor's actual physical presence. You know, I'm in the editing room and I'm obsessively looking at my actors' faces, looking for the best take, the most subtle intonations of their voice. And sometimes I'm even taking sounds from one take and putting them in the mouth of another take. So you become incredibly sensitized to an actor's face and physical presence and voice. And so all of that I had gone through with Vigo in History of Violence really made me feel that he was absolutely the perfect guy for Nikolai.
I want to ask you, Viggo Mortensen, since so many people know you for the Lord of the Rings movies, I'd be really interested in hearing how you got the part of Aragorn in the first place. What did you have to do in the casting process?
I didn't have to do anything. I had to say yes, which I was reluctant to do, to be honest with you. I had just gotten back from a long trip with my son, who was 11 at the time. And I got a phone call from my agent saying that somebody wanted me to go to New Zealand. Do you know Peter Jackson? I'd seen some of his work, and yeah, I knew who he was. Well, he's making The Lord of the Rings, and I said, The Lord of the Rings, I knew of Tolkien. I hadn't read The Lord of the Rings. I'd read about a third of The Hobbit, and I said, well, when is that? And they said, well, you'd have to leave tomorrow, and you know, but you'd be done by Christmas. And I go, oh, well, it's just a few months. They go, no, Christmas of next year. And I said, oh, well, no, I can't. I mean, I haven't read the books, and I was meant to go. They'd already started shooting, and they'd already rehearsed for months, and they wanted me to replace someone, which was also a strange position to be in. So I kind of said, no, really. And my son was there when I was having this conversation, and I hung up, and he knew The Lord of the Rings, and his friends had talked about that book or that series of books, and he said, well, are you talking about Lord of the Rings? And I said, yeah. And he says, they want you to be in that? I said, yeah, but I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, what character? And I told him, and he said, well, you have to do that. That's a great thing to do. And that'd be really cool, Dad. You should do that. So I went. But the main reason I'm glad I did it, apart from the friendships and getting to know New Zealand, a country I like and people that I like a lot, was because I'm sitting here now talking to you with David. And to be honest with you, as much as David might have thought my type of actor or my work was reason to consider me for the character in History of Violence, there's no way that any studio would have let me play that part in History of Violence or Eastern Promises or any of the other things I've done since Lord of the Rings, frankly. Alla Triste, the movie I did in Spain, I wouldn't have gotten those roles if I hadn't achieved, along with everybody else in Lord of the Rings, a certain level of notoriety by virtue of the success in the box office of that trilogy.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Terry. It's a really nice conversation.
David Cronenberg directed the new film Eastern Promises. It stars Viggo Mortensen. Here's music from the soundtrack, composed by Howard Shore. Coming up, a 1988 reissue leads music critic Milo Miles to consider how the music of Sonic Youth holds up. This is Fresh Air. Sonic Youth's album Daydream Nation was released in 1988, and the group was signed to Geffen Records largely because of acclaim for the album from fans and the press. Sonic Youth continues to play as revered art punk elders. This summer, Daydream Nation was reissued in a deluxe edition double CD. Critic Milo Miles considers how well Sonic Youth's work has held up, as well as the sensibility of indie rock and double LPs.
Back in 1988, I wrote a review that paired Daydream Nation with another double LP, U2's Rattle and Hum. But it wasn't an article mechanically dictated by format and release date. The two albums offer contrasting views of rock and roll and its audience. U2 tied to the past, Sonic Youth pointing toward the future. U2 is a band whose grand gestures and air of crusading quests make it ideal for billboards and stadiums. Bono is in his element, communing with tens of thousands. The group lays claim to populist blues and folk rock. Sonic Youth is a band of interiors and side streets. They may proclaim about big issues, but it feels like they're doing it while you watch TV with them in the basement. Guitarist, songwriter, and singer Thurston Moore, in particular, proclaims his heart belongs to avant-garde classical noise and free jazz squawk, not exactly mass audience modes. It feels like Sonic Youth evolved into melodies, hooks, and catchy choruses, more to prove they were not afraid of them than to sell records. But evolve into them, they did. The final difference between U2 and Sonic Youth is that U2 keep faith in the old-fashioned rock and roll notion of delivering a message, the liberation of pop lyric wisdom. As Byron Coley points out in his liner notes to Daydream Nation, the lyrics of Sonic Youth songs are, if not irrelevant, the last thing the band works on. Bassist, singer, and songwriter Kim Gordon occasionally delivers a complete narrative, like Kissability, but the standard method is for a clutch of phrases to stab into your head. And more than ever before for Sonic Youth, on Daydream Nation, the stabs are more pleasure than puzzle. I don't know what Teenage Riot is about exactly, but I sure get the point.
Yeah.
It's often mentioned that Sonic Youth pressed the Geffen label to sign Nirvana as though the bands couldn't be more different. I am sure, however, that the older band recognized that Kurt Cobain had a genius for hammering home catchphrases that stuck with a listener, even if the other words were unhearable. It's just that his obsessions, anger, anguish, and alienation, were more straightforwardly commercial than Sonic Youth's urban collages. The biggest such collage here is the so-called trilogy set, The Wonder, Hyperstation, and Eliminator Jr., which amount to an ode to New York in the 1980s. The city is a wonder town, the capital of Daydream Nation. As the songs fold in on themselves and restart, guitarist and singer Lee Rinaldo and drummer Steve Shelley take particular delight in running the Gotham voodoo down. A consumer note on the extra disc worth of live versions of Daydream Nation songs and cover tunes. They're fun for fans, interesting and sometimes exciting entertainment, but they are not revelatory. The original recordings tell you everything fundamental about the songs. At best, the new material should jolly you into getting a CD of Daydream Nation, or maybe your second CD package. It's worth it, because rock today lives in the intimate indie spaces that fill Daydream Nation.
Music critic Milo Miles lives in Boston. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why the words civility and incivility have become so popular and what that says about us. This is Fresh Air. Time was that people would talk about a decline in manners or politeness. Now they're more likely to express their concerns by talking about a civility crisis. But does the new language signal a different social climate or just a new way of complaining about it? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has had his ear to the ground on this one.
Sometimes a change in the language reflects a change in the world. Sometimes just a change in the way we talk about it. And sometimes it isn't easy to tell. Take civility. It began its life as a word for citizenship and a close kin of civilization. But by the early 20th century, it had dwindled to a genteel term for a nominal courtesy or for perfunctory expressions of politeness, a word that transit companies posted on bus placards in those recurring campaigns aimed at getting riders and employees to be nicer to one another. Back then, people didn't actually talk about civility very much. They were much more likely to complain about bad manners, rudeness, or discourtesy. As late as the 1950s, the words civility and incivility were appearing in the New York Times only about 5 or 6 times a year. The words didn't take off until the 1960s. In 1969 alone, they appeared in the Times more often than they had over the entire 8-year Eisenhower presidency. And by now, they're 30 times more common in the media than they used to be. A lot of people would explain that sudden rise in civility talk as a direct response to a breakdown in public manners. In a public agenda poll a couple of years ago, 3/4 of the respondents said that Americans used to treat each other with more respect and courtesy in the past. But then every generation since Victorian times has had exactly the same impression. Etiquette writers in the 1920s railed about people who monopolized party lines, rude streetcar conductors, women who pushed you out of their way in department stores, hosts who invited you to dinner and then made you listen to their favorite radio programs, and of course the discourteous motorists who were classified as roadster rowdies, coupe cads, and van vandals. Manners are like the English language. It always seems as if things were going just fine until this new generation came along. But that changed in the 60s. To some people, the provocation of the social movements of the period seemed to go beyond mere breaches of decorum, and beyond anything that could be conveyed by old words like impolite, rude, and discourteous. So they reached back to reclaim the older meanings of civility and incivility, which invested personal deportment with a sense of civic and political consequence. In an editorial that appeared just before the 1968 elections, The Wall Street Journal inveighed against what it called the new incivility. As the Journal described them, the culprits included the student protesters, the filthy hecklers who dogged the steps of presidential candidate Hubert Humphrey, and the enraged Negro spokesman who denied any virtue in white civilization. And the offense wasn't just in what all the hippies and protesters were saying, but in their disagreeable physical appearance. Their slovenly hair, beards, and clothing, and their general squalor, the Journal said, showed their contempt for the world of decent manners. As philosophers and sociologists use the word, civility is something distinct from simple politeness. It's more like the attitudes and behavior that make our public discourse possible. But in the mouth of most modern critics, the power of civility and incivility lies precisely in blurring the lines between personal and private life. Incivility seems to draw everything that's coarse, irritating, or merely thoughtless in American daily life into a single deep rent in the nation's moral fabric. It's hard to think of any other social vice that covers as much ground as incivility does. Cell phone abuse, brusque store clerks, airlines that keep people sitting on the tarmac, telemarketers, reality TV, spam, road rage, shock jocks, and nightclub hecklers, not to mention congressional partisanship, attack ads, hostile bloggers, and belligerent talk show hosts. A recent book on incivility in the workplace uses the word for everything from overuse of the fax machine to the excessive use of email acronyms. There's clearly a lot to get worked up about out there, and incivility bundles it all up in a cognitively efficient package. The word by itself does a lot of the work of connecting the contentious tenor of political life to a general decline in personal values. Armed with the notion of incivility, critics can decry the routine crudeness of broadcast expletives, hip-hop lyrics, and gross-out movies like American Pie as the harbingers of imminent social and political disintegration. And on the other side, the word provides a pretext for writing off serious political speech in the same way we dismiss rudeness and intemperateness in everyday life. Speaking disrespectfully of the president, say, becomes morally indistinguishable from saying nasty things about a coworker in the hall. In the course of things, the charge of incivility can close off serious discussion every bit as effectively as more traditional forms of rudeness can. What makes civility and incivility so elastic is that the words live out their entire existence on op-ed pages, with no grounding in the homey truths of everyday life. Parents don't teach their children about civility. They teach them about things like manners, respect, and politeness. Those are the real family values. A lot of the things that people describe as incivility would count as simple bad manners, but a number of them wouldn't. And you have to wonder whether the new cover term is a way of obscuring differences that we ought to be paying attention to.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of the book, Talking Right. If you'd like to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Willie T., the New Orleans pianist, singer, songwriter, and producer. He died Tuesday of complications of colon cancer. He wrote and arranged the music on the 1973 album The Wild Magnolias, which combined Mardi Gras music and funk. Here's a track from the follow-up 1974 album They Call Us Wild, which he also produced.
Support for NPR comes from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, now available on DVD. From Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart, by Ian Ayers, more at supercrunchers.com. And from Courgette Records, presenting Harry Shearer's new release, Songs Pointed and Pointless, original songs, original humor, in stores, online, and at harryshearer.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window cause he couldn't sit still. Juliet was waiting with a safety net. Said, don't bury me cause I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell my father?
On the next Fresh Air, Elvis Costello. There's a new 30th anniversary reissue of his first album, My Aim Is True. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm not satisfied. Well, I remember when the lights went out. And I was trying to make it look like it was never in doubt.